Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. I'm delighted to welcome and introduce Bruce Caldwell for this lecture today, which commemorates the 50th anniversary of Friedrich Hayek's Nobel Prize in Economics of 1974. Hayek, who won the prize jointly with Swedish economist Gunnar Myrdal, taught here at the LSE from 1931 to 1950. Bruce is currently a research professor of economics and the director of the Centre for the History of Political Economy at Duke University. His first book, Beyond Positivism, Economic Methodology in the 20th Century, explored the relationship between 20th century philosophy of science and the writings of economists on questions of economic methodology. This early interest is one I share and was how I first got to know Bruce at a workshop in Amsterdam. But for the past three decades, Bruce's research has principally focused on the multifaceted writings of the Nobel Prize-winning economist and social theorist Hayek. Following that interest, Caldwell is the author of Hayek's Challenge, an intellectual biography of F.A. Hayek. He's the general editor of the collected works of Hayek and the editor of MPS 1947, which is the transcript of the founding meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society. He is currently working with Hans-Jörg Klausinger on a family-authorised biography of Hayek titled Hayek, A Life. Bruce Caldwell has held research fellowships here at the LSE, at New York University, at Cambridge University, and at the Hoover Institution. He is past president and a distinguished fellow of both the History of Economic Society and the Southern Economic Association, and a life member of Clare Hall in Cambridge. Following Bruce's talk, there will be time for questions from the floor and from our online audience. And this session is recorded and it will go up on YouTube. Finally, I'd like to say that this session is organised by the LSE Hayek Programme at Stickard. And if you'd like to find out more about that, please Google the LSE Hayek Programme and find out about future events. And now I'd like to hand over, thank you very much for coming, to Bruce, who will give us the lecture. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you so much, Mary, for that very generous introduction. And I'm here to talk about Hayek on the 50th anniversary of his receiving the Nobel Prize, jointly with the Swedish economist Gunnar Myrdal. And it's especially appropriate, as Mary had noted, that we celebrate that here, given his long relationship with the London School of Economics. And I'm new to doing PowerPoint, so you'll have to bear with me as I click or don't click through these slides. But let's see. Yep. Okay. So I wanted just to talk about some of the various things that Hayek did while he was here at the London School of Economics. As Mary has noted, he came here in 1931. He was initially a visiting professor. He then became the Tuck Professor of Economic Science and Statistics, a fairly strange combination to be associated perhaps with Hayek's later work in methodology in particular, which we'll talk about here. He joined Lionel Robbins' seminar, sometimes called the Grand Seminar, perhaps by Lionel Robbins. I'm not sure where it got that particular label. But Robbins ran it along with Arnold Plant, and when Hayek arrived, he became a person that also ran the seminar. But it was one of those wonderful gatherings of powerful intellects in the history of economics. I'm just going to run through some of the more prominent names, but the list goes much beyond this. And if we look at people who came and visited, you know, traveling through London or came for just to give some special lectures, it would be much longer. So in addition to Robbins, Hayek, and Plant, there was John Hicks, Nicholas Kaldor, Abba Lerner, Ronald Coase, Aaron Director came for a time, Evan Durbin, Michael Kolesky, Ludwig Lachmann, Tibor Skotowski, George Shackle, Brinley Thomas, And even for a time as a student, David Rockefeller. And Tibor Skatowski tells the story that Rockefeller showed up during the terms when they were talking about public finance, and apparently Robbins assigned him the topic of tax avoidance. Do a paper on tax avoidance, he said to Rockefeller. So obviously they got along. In addition to participating in the intellectual life of the London School of Economics, Hayek also, during the Wart period, took over basically as the editor of Economica, the house journal. They had an editorial team, but many of the people who were on that team, got busy with government work during the war, so a lot of the tasks fell to Hayek. The LSE is also where, I think it could be argued, he did all or at least most of his most famous work. Okay, it at least initiated stuff that he would continue on later. But if we think about his contributions, for example, to the theory of money and the trade cycle, and his debates with John Maynard Keynes and when he first arrived, by the mid-1930s, he started to engage with some of the socialists on the faculty, but also academic socialists in general. He came out with a book that was edited, that carried a foreword and an afterword by Hayek called Collectivist Economic Planning. And it was here that he offered his first critiques of socialism, building on the work of Ludwig von Mises. He also, in 1940, in a book review of a book by Lange and another by H.G. Dickinson, extended that further. And then finally, of course, his most famous work, 1944, The Road to Serfdom. A third contribution that he made was his contribution to what has been dubbed subsequently as the knowledge problem. This is the idea that a well-functioning market system is a marvel. He used the word marvel. He said if somebody had actually invented this, they would be given a status equivalent of a Newton. But this is something that emerges due to the interactions of millions of people. He describes this process most convincingly, I think, in his paper, The Use of Knowledge in Society, published in 1945. Among economists, this is probably the most famous paper that Hayek created. And his argument was that it's a marvel, a market system is a marvel, because it's able to coordinate the actions of millions of people who have individual pieces of localized knowledge, who can't survey the entire scene, but they're making contributions based on what they see. And this coordinates it in a way that allows us to flourish. I think we can talk about the use of knowledge in society as the paper that he expresses this, but I think the idea is most accessible if we actually go back, because these are ancient ideas that he's expressing in modern language, to Frederick Bastiat, who had an essay, How Does Paris Get Fed? And what he expresses in this, and I think this captures the idea very well, is no one sets out to feed Paris. Yet every day, day in and day out, for centuries, Paris has gotten fed. How does it happen? And it's millions of people who are just doing whatever their particular task happens to be. Now, of course, we see evidence in people like waiters, maitre d's, cooks, wait service, or people who are growing the food. But think about all of the other sorts of contributors, people who are working on roads that allow the produce to get from the farm to the market to the restaurant, ultimately. Think about people who are working in mines that are digging ore that gets ultimately transformed into the various utensils that people might be using. And you can go on and make, go over lots of different professions that are all contributing to the feeding of Paris. If you asked any one of the people who worked in those professions, are you a person who feeds Paris, they would laugh at you. But this is this coordination that takes place in a well-functioning market system. Well-functioning is a very important caveat to put there. And sometimes market systems don't work well, but this is the magic of the market system, why so many economists, even those who are critical of a market system, often will acknowledge this. Certainly Oscar Lange was somebody that Hayek disagreed with, who was quite very much in agreement with him. He also undertook institutional work. It's not mentioned in the slide. He was at LSE that he helped organize the Colloque Lippmann in 1938 and subsequently the Mont Pelerin Society meeting in 1947, which was a meeting of liberals from around Europe and North America, many of them meeting each other for the first time. He was worried about the fate of liberalism in the post-war period, and this was an attempt to bring them together to discuss the principles of liberalism, the foundations of a liberalism that might be appropriate for the 20th century. So, those were his contributions. The one that Mary and I were very interested in, as well as some other people who I see in the audience, were his contributions to methodology, okay? And this probably is a strange word to many people. So what are methodological questions? These are things like, what does it mean to say that economics is a science? Okay, what does that mean? Okay. Do different sciences follow different procedures, or do they all follow the same procedure? How might these procedures be justified? Now, you have to say, this is not the sort of question that would normally be thought of as something that an economist might ask, okay? Economists know what they're doing, they're scientists. Why would people ask these questions? And to be sure, people generally ask this question in periods of self-doubt or doubt about the profession or some sort of despair or whatever. I thought I'd tell you my own little story, okay? So if you'll indulge me just for a minute. I got interested in methodology when I got into grad school. So I had studied economics as an undergrad, and I'm sure this is not going to be true. All of you undergraduates out there, you're here at LSE or related colleges, this is not going to happen to you, okay? This is not going to happen to you. But I'll just tell you my question. This is the 70s. 70s was a weird time, okay? It was a weird time. So I'm sure it's different now. But I took my courses as an undergraduate in economics, and I really enjoyed them. I thought it really gave me some insight into how the world worked, different sorts of policy attempts to make the world work better, etc. And I got to grad school, and I was very disappointed, but I was also perplexed. There was a big, much more emphasis, now the emphasis is on empirical work, much more so than it was back then. The emphasis was on theory then, and the theoretical emphasis, I was taking these classes, and it seemed to me that we were just repeating what I had learned in my theory classes as an undergraduate, but at a more general level of mathematical sophistication. And I didn't feel like I was learning anything new. I was just working very hard to express what I already knew in a language that was a little more sophisticated. When we got to the empirical work, well, took econometrics classes, but then I would get into some applied fields. And I can distinctly remember taking the first day of my industrial organization class. We walked in and the teacher said, well, you know, we're gonna look at lots and lots of empirical studies in here. But I'll tell you, as far as I can see, there's only two robust relationships in IO. And one of them was something like market share and profits are positively correlated. Like, yeah, okay. I mean, do we really need studies to show that? So, I mean, I just didn't understand why we were approaching these topics in this way. And I have to say also, it was the 1970s. I was a teaching assistant in a macroeconomics introductory class. And you know, we have a Keynesian cross diagram. You students may not remember, know this, but C plus I plus G is aggregate demand. And you have full employment, GNP or GDP marked. And there's a gap where you are now. But you calculate the multiplier and it allows you to calculate the exact amount of aggregate demand to get to that point where you get to full employment GDP with low inflation or zero inflation in this model. And you're looking out at the world and you've got inflation and you've got growing unemployment. You've got stagflation. And you know, I'm teaching the students this stuff and I'm saying, you know, I don't really believe what's going on because it doesn't seem to match what's going on in the world. And yeah, people would ask questions. So I would go to my professors and ask questions. I'd say, yeah, why are we doing science this way? What happened? Yeah, I remember showing a professor the Phillips curve saying, yeah, here's the dots on this long-term relationship between unemployment and inflation. And here's where we are, and all these dots are way up here. He says, well, it's shifted. The Phillips curve has shifted. I said, why did it shift? You know, what's... Well, that was it. So, I mean, I was a dissatisfied student, okay? That's how I got into methodology. Other people get into it in lots of different ways. I don't know how Mary did. But that was my initial interest. And as Mary said, my dissertation, which became my first book, was just simply to look at what philosophers of science, surely they know what science is about, how to do science. It's the philosophy of science. Look at the writings of philosophy of science in the 20th century, and then look at some of the debates that economists had engaged in. Famous economists, Milton Friedman, Paul Samuelson, Fritz Machlis, Terence Hutchison. Variety of economists in the 20th century who debated what it meant to do economics in a scientific way. And what I saw was that, first of all, economists usually didn't talk much about it, but those who did talk about the specific methodology that they were purporting or supporting tended to invoke the philosophy of science known as logical positivism. More recently, kind of in the 50s and 60s, it would be logical empiricism, some sort of positivist doctrine. This is a particular vision of science that viewed science as something that was cumulatively progressive. You generate theories, you test the theories. The theories that survive this testing process, this is a gradual accumulation of knowledge. And the best theories are the ones, how do you judge the one theory that's better than another? They are better able to make predictions of the future, okay? Able to make better forecasts. And this was the general image of science when economists who I was reading in these debates were portraying. Now, it seemed to me that this didn't very well capture what I saw in economics, number one, but there was another bit. Among philosophers of science, positivist philosophy of science was dead. One of the early essays I read, which was from the 1970s by Patrick Supes, famous philosopher of science, he said, "The Swan Song for Positivism." That was the title of his essay. So, in other words, economists, when they didn't care about methodology, when they talked about it, they were invoking a defunct philosophy of science that was actually designed with the physical sciences in mind. So, to me, I didn't answer my questions, okay? I wasn't able to answer the question why economics looks the way it did. It did get me a book, though, and Nick Breeley, who is the person who was the acquisitions editor for Allen & Unwin, who accepted this book, is here tonight, so I'm very glad to be able to see his face after all these years. Okay, that's my personal story. Then I discovered Hayek's critique. Okay, so I wasn't led to Hayek from an ideological perspective. Hayek, when he was a college student, thought he was basically a Fabian socialist. I didn't even know the words Fabian socialist, but I thought of myself as kind of a standard left-winger back in the day. So it wasn't ideological, anything ideological that drew me to Hayek. I wanted to start to look at people who wrote about how to do science, economic science, from a perspective that was different from the mainstream perspective. So I looked at post-Keynesian writers, I looked at institutionalists, I looked at the Austrians, and I came upon Hayek. And Hayek challenged the whole idea that the positivist vision was an appropriate vision for a science like economics, okay? Being from Vienna, he actually knew about the people who first promoted logical positivism, okay? He was invited to be a member of the Vienna Circle. He turned them down. He didn't do it, but he was a member of the Mises Circle, the Mises Christ, and they had a mole, they had a spy who was in attending. So they knew what was going on in the Vienna Circle, but they didn't directly participate. So he knew about the development of these ideas. And his vision was that economics was a science, but that it's limited, okay? It faced limits. And as Mary said, this is my first book was called Hayek's Challenge. And the subtitle of that, its subtitle is Intellectual History of F.A. Hayek. That was the University of Chicago Press marketing people. They said, you can't use the title that you actually chose, okay? The book's not gonna sell. The actual title was Hayek's Challenge, F.A. Hayek and the Limits of Social Science, okay? That was his message. It was a book about the methodology of economics. So of course, when the book got reviewed, people would say, this isn't an intellectual biography of F.A. Hayek, this is about methodology, it's methodological stuff. That's right. But I just want to clarify that in case you pick it up and wonder why it was that way. I want to thank LSE personally because a lot of the work that I did on that book I accomplished while I was the Lockman Fellow at the Center for the Philosophy of Natural and Social Sciences here at LSE in the early 2000s. So I owe a great debt to LSE for giving me the time off to be able to complete them. Now, we know that these methodological issues, even if we haven't heard of them before tonight, must have been important to Hayek. Because Hayek, in fact, in his Nobel address, it's called The Pretense of Knowledge, but it's actually about methodology. So what I'd like to do is to try, in the time that remains, is first to give you a little bit of the background of how he came to the specific ideas that he articulated in his Nobel address. I'd like to do a little compare and contrast with Gunnar Myrdal, because they really are polar opposites in so many different ways. And it's a good, I think it really helps to illustrate the particular time, moment in time when this was occurring, and also the difference in views, and then invite us to all think about what implications, if any, his ideas might have for the current time. It's working. Okay, so as I said, when he came to LSE in the 1930s, he reviewed Keynes' Treatise on Money. Keynes hated the review. They got into an exchange in the academic journals that was sufficiently impressive that I don't know if people still look at these things, but about a decade ago there was two rap videos on the Keynes-Hayek duel. So in fact, I mean, it was good enough that they actually made rap videos better. Good enough? Who knows? But anyway, that was a famous early exchange. He then was criticizing socialism, but these are academic debates, and I think what was really concerning Hayek as he moved into the 1930s was the larger public reaction to the phenomena that was the Great Depression, which was horrible worldwide. It was particularly bad, of course, in England because the 20s was also bad. And so after the 20s, the 30s was worse. Okay? This early 30s was worse. So what were the reactions among the intelligentsia? Well, first of all, the capitalism clearly had failed. Okay, it wasn't working in the 20s. It got worse in the 30s. We need to replace it with something. You look to the continent, all of the examples there look pretty bad. You've got the Soviet Union, the newly created state there, which was communist, didn't look particularly attractive, although they were promoting it pretty strong in the early 30s in England. You look to the continent, you got fascism of various sorts, springing up in Spain, in Italy, you've got Nazi Germany coming along. And the intelligentsia and the general public, looking at these other alternatives, found none of them particularly palatable. And what emerged, and it was called the middle way, okay? The middle way, which sounds so reasonable, the middle way, okay? The middle way between these extreme positions. That was basically democratic socialism. That was what was being promoted by the intelligentsia, but also, as we'll see, by another group. Now, some of the people, of course, at LSE were also promoting this, so he did engage in academic debates, but the people that he started to really resent, you can sense that resentment is not too strong a word, are people that we'll call the men of science, okay? The men of science. And is this Hayek's term? No, it's their term. That's what these people were calling themselves. If you know C.P. Snow, he has a series of wonderful novels about life in the Cambridge colleges in the 30s. And there was one particular character who appears in a number of the books named Crawford. And he was someone who would get up at a faculty meeting and pontificate and say, well, speaking as a man of science, and then go on and say whatever his opinion was, okay? So this was kind of the feeling, and you could see this in some of the public things that I'll mention. So there's a set of very prominent natural scientists, all of whom were quite left-wing. I'll just mention a few names, a physicist, J.D. Bernal, P.M.S. Blackett, who went on to get a Nobel Prize, J.B.S. Haldane, who was a biochemist and geneticist. These were, you know, polymaths who were brilliant people. The wonderfully named Lancelot Hogben, who was a colleague of Hayek's at LSE, was in the social biology chair. But these people's voices were everywhere. They gave public lectures. They were on the BBC. They were book club members. They had books that were distributed. Many of their books were popular books about learning science, but all of them had the message that, you know, science was being constrained under the current system, that science was something that was going to allow us to basically make the world not only a much better place, but a much more just place, and indeed eliminate scarcity. And this was the promise that science held out. I'll give you just a few quotes. If you want to see more, I can send you to other references. But Blackett, in March 1934, in a BBC lecture, it was titled "The Frustration of Science," and that later became a book that he edited with a number of other contributors of the Men of Science. And he concluded the lecture, "I believe there's only two ways to go, and the way we now seem to be starting leads to fascism." Okay? If we don't do anything, we're going to end up in a fascist state. "I believe the only other way is complete socialism. Socialism will want all the science it can get to produce the greatest possible wealth. Scientists have perhaps not very long to make up their minds on which side they stand." So it's saying, come on, brothers, we need to get together on the side of socialism. Same book, J.D. Bernal agrees, "If science is to help humanity, if we're going to be able to help humanity, it must find a new master." This is going to be a very persuasive argument in the middle of the Great Depression, let me tell you. Lancelot Hogman was less about promoting science as deriding what the economists were doing. He sent this wonderful letter to the director of the LSE, Lord Beveridge, talking about the Hayek-Robbins circus-teaching ultra-individualist metaphysical nonsense. The key word there is metaphysical. I mean, of course he thought it was nonsense, but metaphysical, that means non-scientific, okay? This is not science. More generally, he gave a Conway lecture in which he said, "Economics as it's studied in our universities is the astrology of the machine age." Wonderful phrasing, wonderful phrase. So economics is under attack by people outside of economics who are scientists, who are saying it's these people who believe in this system that we need to get rid of. So a couple of messages then: capitalism is not only immoral, it's inefficient, and it's anti-science. And we need to get to that. And economics as it's currently taught is, underlined, not science. Okay? Just trying to motivate why Hayek might be interested in such arcane sorts of things. There we go. Okay, he's Hayek. So he decides to write a two-volume work. All right. This is going to be his great effort during the war. The first volume would explore the origin of the views that he disliked in the 19th century, starting in France, École Polytechnique, moving to Germany, then moving to England, then moving to the United States, Comte, Saint-Simon, positivism, science, and socialism kind of being joined together in that early period, and then moving in various ways. And it would take different forms, this idea that you can control society and use science in some way to control society, that emerged in different places in very different forms. So in Germany, you know, you've got conservative imperialists associated with Bismarck. If you look at England, it's Fabian socialists. If you look at the United States, you've got progressives. Very different politics, but all with a certain confidence that with the right finagling or fixing, we can make it so that science can create a much better world than the world that we're living in. And this is a very, obviously, this is attracting everybody in the room. Why is Hayek resisting this? Now, he never finishes this abuse of reason project, this big, large project. He realizes it's probably not appropriate if he's trying to respond to this wave of enthusiasm. And instead turns to the road to serfdom. So that's what he publishes. It gives him his 15 minutes of fame. This becomes a very important book, a very misunderstood book, I would argue. And in Q&A, we can talk about any of this stuff. We don't have to go back to methodology. But that's what has his attention. But he also publishes in the war years an essay called Scientism and the Study of Society. Okay? Scientism and the Study of Society. And this is was meant to be an introduction to the larger work. He defined scientism as the slavish imitation of the method and language of science a very prejudiced approach which, before it's considered its subject, claims to know what is the most appropriate way of investigating it. Okay? And he then draws a contrast in this essay between what he called the objectivism, the collectivism, and the historicism of the scientistic approach. These are the things that he dislikes. Objectivism, collectivism, and historicism. He contrasts this with subjectivism, individualism, and a theoretical approach. And for those of you who study economics, what he's basically saying there is that this approach that economists are taking is the appropriate approach, that the critics, the men of science, are invoking these other things to criticize economics, and his claim is that actually the economics approach is the truly scientific one. So this is obviously, it's aimed at trying to respond to these arguments that he was hearing in the 1930s. Now, in the course of the text, Scientism and the Study of Society, he gives examples. So for the objectivist approach, behaviorism in psychology, which said the only way that only things that we can take into account in doing psychology is things that are observable. Okay. Sociology and the work of Wesley Thayer Mitchell and John Maynard Keynes would be examples of a collectivist approach. The German historical school would be the historical approach. So he had different groups and different examples. He's kind of blending these things all together. But the basic idea was these are all groups that are claiming that they are the real science. And he's responding to him saying, nah, we're the real science. What is going on during this period, basically, and this is something that, if you look at the history of economics, particularly through the eyes of someone who is interested in methodology, now these debates run throughout the course of the history of economics. You saw it between the Methodenstreit is about methods between the German historical school and the Austrians back in at the end of the 1800s. But it's constantly having different groups who are saying, no, we're the real scientists, so you should listen to us. Okay, because we're the ones who really know what we're talking about. Okay, so two key claims that he makes in the essay are, first, the social sciences are often limited to what he called explanations of the principle or pattern predictions. He gives a lovely example in the Scientism essay about explanations of the principle. He says, think of a footpath. Now, I'm looking around LSE, and unlike many college campuses, you're not going to see these footpaths. But if you were in a more rural setting, you'll see sidewalks that are designed to make the place look good, and then you'll see lots and lots of footpaths that are created by students who need to get from point A to point B, and they need to get there more quickly than one would if we walked along the nice paths. So he says, we never observed, this is his bit about psychology hasn't. We never observed a footpath formed. But all of us know how a footpath gets formed, okay? We understand people are trying to get from point A to point B, okay? We understand their subjective utility in doing this. And we can explain the principle by which this footpath gets formed. A less homely example might be one that he used later, which was evolutionary theory. He says, think about evolutionary theory. It's based on three principles: random variation, heritability, and the selection for traits that enhance survival and reproductive success. Those are the principles by which evolution occurs. We can't, because we know those principles, predict the change in speciation that will occur, but it explains how that occurs. Okay? There's too many things going on in the world for us to be able to predict, but we can explain, and we can explain in terms of the patterns that emerge. So pattern prediction is another part of it. Now, I'll just point out, this directly contradicts the idea that successful sciences are going to be defined as those that are able to make ever better predictions. Okay? If you think that evolutionary theory is scientific, it is not going to fit that model. And Hayek's point, secondly, and this is the second argument, is failing to understand that allows you to slip into the engineering mentality, the idea that you think you can reconstruct society just like engineers construct a bridge. It will give you that hubris that science, which is powerful, is going to enable you to be able to do it. This is the argument that he was making in the Scientism essay. So I gave you the background in terms of what his what he was trying to accomplish, you know, who he was arguing with. The road to serfdom, though, takes over his life. It gets Reader's Digest publication of it. It you know, really makes him kind of a public figure for a while. And ultimately, the Scientism stuff takes a back seat. So we'll move to the second step. This wonderful, another wonderful seminar. It's a seminar that he organized. He moved to the University of Chicago in 1950 and immediately started reproducing some of the things that he had at LSE, indeed that had occurred before he got to LSE in Vienna. He organized his seminars. And he organized one in 52-53 on scientific method and the study of society. And the Counter-Revolution of Science and the Sensory Order were the two books that he wrote that he assigned, but the reading list was very, very long. And what he did was invited professors from all over the University of Chicago to come and discuss these things, okay? It wasn't a student seminar, there were students there, but it was mostly he was trying to get professors who would engage in discussion and the students would thereby learn from it. And the group that he was able to attract to this is incredible. In addition to the people on the Committee on Social Thought, which is where he was, people like Milton Friedman, Aaron Director, who was his brother-in-law, Gary Becker, who was a brand new student at the University of Chicago, Abba Lerner was in town, so he would come down. There were economists on the Coles Commission. Okay, the Coles Commission was then located at the University of Chicago. Perhaps the most prominent of them, Schelling Koopmans. And also there were natural scientists, the physicist Enrico Fermi, Leo Szilard, population geneticist Sewell Wright. So these people were all there discussing what is science, okay? The very methodological question that we started with. Should it be practiced in different ways in different fields, etc.? And Hayek was hoping to have all these smart people talk about this and he would be able to get his point in. Now, I think we can say three things came out of this seminar, we can safely say. First of all, no one would have understood a word of the sensory order, okay? This is a book that just came out, and every Hayek scholar I know has struggled with it and read it maybe two or three times, knowing the full background of Hayek and tried to make sense of it. People picking this thing up would not have been able to respond to it. The second thing that would have come out, if you know the history of the University of Chicago, Friedman and the Coles Commission people were really in violent disagreement with each other about almost everything. Okay? They were ideologically on different sides of the scale. So Friedman and his cohort, much more free market. The others were mostly European socialists who had come to Chicago. They had different theories. The Coles Commission people were much more enthusiastic about Keynesian theory. The Chicago School was you know, really aggressively opposed to Keynesian economics. And there was a lot of questions about money, because this was from the 1945, 48, say, onwards, when the Cold War really started to become the Cold War. There was a lot of foundation money, a lot of government money that was now being funneled to these various groups that were proposing new techniques for studying social phenomena. So this became a fight for money, for prestige, etc. And it's fascinating, this methodology seminar to promote his views. And what he saw was that not just people he disagreed with, but people he agreed with had the same image of science, that the way that you practice science in a way that is respectable is to come up with theories that make ever better predictions. Scientism is not just associated with men of science or socialists. Fellow classical liberals, mainstream economists, they all have the same image. It may not have come out in the seminar, but the third thing that he would have gotten from this is that nobody bought his distinction of the sciences, that the natural sciences and the social sciences followed different methods, okay? His book was, Karl Popper, his close friend, had told him as much in a very polite Viennese way earlier. But when this book came out that reprinted the Scientism essay, which had originally been published in Economica, it was reviewed by philosophers Ernest Nagel, who was a student of Dewey's, but still, I think it wasn't a matter of that. But May Brodbeck, they were all just saying that this distinction doesn't, you know, this is just wrong. Go back to the drawing board. So being Hayek, he in fact did go back to the drawing board and comes up with a paper called Degrees of Explanation. Degrees of Explanation. Think about that phrase. He writes this paper. I won't go into a lot of the details about it, but he sends it off to Chester Barnard, who is the head of the Rockefeller, former head of the Rockefeller Foundation, was by then head of the National Science Foundation. He sent it on to a guy named Warren Weaver, who was the director of the Division of Natural Sciences at the Rockefeller Foundation, who sent Hayek some comments and also Warren Weaver's own paper, Science and Complexity. And this for Hayek, I think, was a light bulb sort of moment, because the distinction that Warren Weaver drew was not between natural science and social science, but sciences that study simple versus those that study complex phenomena. So Weaver's paper examined the development of science through time. It's kind of a historical account. He claimed that progress was first made in physics and other disciplines by solving two variable problems which studied simple phenomena. And you're able to make point predictions there. We can tell exactly when the lunar eclipse is going to occur. Around 1900, scientists began investigating phenomena of disorganized complexity, in which there's a large number of variables and their individual behaviors unknown. But for such phenomena, statistics can allow us to discover if the whole system exhibited any orderly characteristics. Then Weaver said the last frontier that was just then being reached was the study of phenomena of organized complexity. Here there exists a large number of variables that are interrelated in various ways, so the usual statistical techniques were not applicable. Something that would have made Hayek jump for joy is one of the examples he says is the price of wheat. Okay, what's going to happen to the price of wheat? We can't tell what it's going to be in 6 months. Too many things going on that would affect it. In a footnote at the beginning of his paper, Hayek states simply, the problems of complexity to which the further discussion in my paper refers are of the kind which Warren Weaver has described as the problems of organized complexity. Now, another key point that he makes in his essay is that this is not just applicable to economics. There's a host of sciences that study phenomena of organized complexity, for which the positivist idea of making ever better predictions is a will-o'-the-wisp, just can't be done. He actually names them. He says not only evolutionary theory, mathematical biology, mathematical economics, he's thinking of general equilibrium theory. He was not anti-mathematics. He was appreciating how these sorts of things showed you the underlying structures that might be in play. Cybernetics, the theory of automata, general systems theory, perhaps also communication theory. Okay, now I don't know if you're going to be able to see this next one or read it, but this to me is the most representative statement of Hayek's views. It's really long and you might not be able to read it. Can people see it at all? Yeah? Some can see it, okay? Those send the hands that go up or towards the front. I'll just say that this go ahead and read through it. He's saying that if you're studying complex phenomena, it's going to be hard to disprove theories about the way these phenomena work. It's going to be hard to test them. There's not going to be crucial experiments that allows you to decide this theory's right and this theory's wrong. It's the opposite vision of that progressive accumulation of theories that allow you to make ever better forecasts. And he said, but it does not help to hold up against this example of other sciences where the situation is different. Okay? There's no basis for the contention that they're due to the immaturity of the sciences concerned to be a complete misunderstanding of the argument of the essay to think that this was something that was going to go away. This is not something that we're going to be able to fix when we get some better techniques put into place. It's a very strong claim, and I think the representative view. And if you're interested in this element of Hayek's work, I recommend that you take a look at the essays that are collected in The Market and Other Orders. This is one of the volumes in the Hayek Collected Works. You will not be surprised that it is a volume that I edited, and these are all my favorite essays, basically, because they're all on various development of his ideas along these lines. So let's get to finally to the Nobel Address. I'm okay on time? Yeah? Okay. So they're both notified in October 1974 that they'd won the Nobel Prize. The citation said, for pioneering work for both of them in the theory of money and economic fluctuations and penetrating analysis of the interdependence of economic, social, and institutional phenomena. There was a backstory to Myrdal and Hayek. They didn't like each other, and they'd known each other for a long time and never liked each other. The way they first came into contact was Hayek was organizing a volume that was going to be published in German, a Festschrift sort of volume, and he asked the Swedish economist Erik Lindahl to contribute. At the last minute, Lindahl pulls out, but says, look, I'm not going to leave you in the lurch. I've got this young guy here who has written an essay on monetary economics that can sub in. We'll translate it into German. They sent it to Hayek. He looked at it. He hated it. He didn't like it. But he felt obligated to publish it. And this was then later published as Monetary Equilibrium, which was the thing that they're citing in the Nobel thing. So Hayek helped Myrdal get the Nobel Prize. It's just I'm sure it just was driving him a little bit crazy. So they're very, very different. Very, very different in terms of their ideological views. This comes out very clearly in the New York Times after the Nobel was announced. They were both asked, what would they do if about the current environment in which inflation was getting out of control? And listen to their answers. Myrdal says wage and price controls and gasoline rationing, because it was OPEC, so gasoline was one of the things that was really pushing prices up. Hayek said, temporary increase in unemployment. He's trying to sugarcoat it. Temporary increase in unemployment is what's necessary to bring down inflation. Okay, and of course, Myrdal's position was by far the much more popular one at the time, not only because generating unemployment is not ever going to be popular, but I mean the idea that wage price controls and rationing was the way to handle inflation. In the United States, Richard Nixon in August 1971 imposed a 90-day wage price freeze, and then there was price controls that were in place for a number of years after that, selectively taken off as time went on. So it's I think important that again at that moment in time he thought there was a crisis that demanded a look at methodology. So his title of his paper was the paper that he gives as his Nobel address is The Pretense of Knowledge. But his original idea was to call it The Dangers of the Scientistic Error. Okay, that's an awkward title. But he also, in a letter later, said, yeah, I was thinking about doing that because it would be a more forthright title, but he was afraid that some overeager copy editor would see the word scientistic and change it to scientific. So he was afraid he would be doubly misunderstood. So he ends up calling it The Pretense of Knowledge. And he really is pretty aggressive approach. Right in his toast that is given the day before his lecture, he's already saying, he's worried about the Nobel conferring this aura of expertise on economists to make pronouncements that may go beyond their areas of study and set them up as experts that he was worried about. So you can see his toast there. I mean, the salient sentence, I would say, there's no reason why a man who has made a distinctive contribution to economic science should be omnicompetent on all problems of society, as the press tends to treat him, till in the end he may himself be persuaded to believe. So he's worried about the aura of expertise that this could confer, this sort of prize could confer. So what does he say in his address? He starts out by saying, well, we're in quite a mess. He says, the problem we now face that I have to mention at first is accelerating inflation, which it must be admitted has been brought about by policies which the majority of economists recommended or even urged governments to pursue. As a profession, we have made a mess of things. This is him being polite. He feels that the rest of the profession has made a mess of things. Now, where did this mess come from? He said, well, we follow this particular model, and we're never mentions the word Keynes, but he talks about demand management. So it's clearly a Keynesian model. And we're doing, the reason that this is such an attractive model to us is that it talks about aggregate data, and that this is attractive to us because it makes us feel that, that this is truly scientific. You know, unemployment rates, inflation rates, growth rates, etc. And that we can manipulate them in a way that will allow us to solve a problem that we might be facing. So his view was that this was the wrong model, but that we were attracted to this sort of model because it was something that allowed us to talk about data in a very obvious way. He says, if you think about my understanding of how a market system works, it's really based on the individual decisions of millions of people interacting in markets. You don't really have that kind of data there. As we said, we're not going to know the price of wheat in 6 months. You do have data, but it's this individualized data that's not aggregatable and able to be manipulated. So his point, though, in the larger lecture, is to say that economics is just one example of this, that this is, in fact, a much more ubiquitous sort of problem. And he actually talks about the limits of growth. Now, this is a very significant piece of work. It was a project that talked about mankind's predicament. Okay, that was the subtitle of it. That were worried about things like resource depletion, population growth, and environmental degradation. And it was basically a precursor to the models of today's climate change models. Okay, this is what the origins of the thing. So, the grandfathers of the models that people are discussing and debating today is something that he was calling out at the time and saying this is something that he thinks has the pretense of science but is not really scientific. By the way, just as an aside, for those of you who know about Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich and the bet, I mean, he was great friends with Julian Simon, who was someone who poo-pooed this argument about degradation. And they made a bet that we can talk about that in the Q&A. But Hayek became kind of a mutual admiration society. They discovered each other kind of late. They have lots of letters back and forth to each other. Hayek concludes his address somewhat apocalyptically. The recognition of the insuperable limits to his knowledge ought indeed teach any student of society a lesson in humility, striving. To control society not only makes him a tyrant over his fellows. That's a direct reference to Keynes, by the way. This is a phrase that Keynes used in the closing chapter of General Theory. This is Hayek's way of doing these things. He seldom directly says a person's name, but he makes references that the person certainly would know, and anyone who was in knowledgeable would know. But it is an apocalyptic vision. Not only a tyrant over his fellows, a destroyer of a civilization which no brain has designed, but which has grown from the free efforts of millions of individuals. Now, Myrdal's lecture could not be more different, and I think, actually, that indeed it was meant as a response to Hayek's lecture, because he gives it 3 months later, so he would have already known about Hayek's lecture. Its title was The Equality Issue in World Development. Myrdal thought that the world, especially the developing world, was facing enormous challenges. And he lists them: the oil crisis, but also a food crisis, a population explosion, depletion of non-renewable resources. These are all the things that the Club of Rome mentioned in their report that Hayek was criticizing. The amount of humanitarian aid, said Myrdal, given by the U.S. and other developed countries was minuscule. It needs to be ramped up. And in addition, the developed countries need to cut back their own consumption. So here are some of the lines from his address: the cutting down of consumption, of production for home consumption, of many other items besides food, and all in the developed countries is rational and in our own interest. This is what the discussion of quality of life should be about. Our economic growth in a true sense can be continued, but it should be directed differently. We need to plan it in a planned way to serve our real interests in life. Okay, I will just give you a look at one of the things that he also says. I'm in deep sympathy with the urgings of medical men, environmentalists, and other colleagues of the natural sciences. So he's invoking the views of natural scientists on economic questions, invoking science to try to change our views on the best way forward. There were differing responses to the addresses. Hayek had been the editor of Economica, so he offered his address to Economica to publish. The editor, Ray Richardson, said, okay, we'll accept it, but there's a general opinion of the editors, I'm quoting the board, that the Nobel Prize ceremony probably inhibits laureates from giving as scholarly and as well-ordered account of their views as they might wish. And then they recommended 5 points for him to revise the paper. Okay, so they want him to revise his Nobel address so that it would be acceptable for publication in Economica. This is a black, I think, a black mark on the editorship at that particular moment in time. Hayek just withdrew it. You know, he's Hayek. He's not going to try to push something like that. Myrdal's lecture, though, is wildly applauded. Alfred Kastner, a Nobel laureate in physics, sent out a circular letter to his fellow laureates asking them to read and to meditate upon Myrdal's lecture, reminding them of their responsibility to use their public prestige to help make things go in the right direction and prevent the misuse of science. So you've got that whole discourse again about what is science and whose side is science on. Hayek sent a telegram to Kastner saying he disagreed, as you can imagine. Okay, so let's conclude. What conclusions to draw from what Hayek said? And we can think about whether we believe it or not. Certainly, his major point is that economics is a science, okay? But it's one that studies complex phenomena. Because it studies complex phenomena, we can do with it much less in terms of reshaping society in ways that we think better. So, what sort of implications here? Certainly, economists are often asked by the public to make forecasts about the future, about this complex thing called the economy. And it's not something that we're very good at, and all economists know that. Some economists make their living by selling forecasts, so they, of course, are not going to publicize it. But basically, if you actually could forecast, why would you tell anyone about it? You just go out and invest yourself. You know, you'd make the money yourself. Now, this is a well-known shortcoming if we think of the positivist view of what a science should be. But it's long-standing. Fritz Machlup, who was a colleague of Hayek's, had a wonderful, he was always making jokes. I sat in on his class for a while when I was at NYU. And he said, his definition of a good economist is someone who can tell you today why his forecast yesterday about tomorrow was wrong, okay? Can explain where it went wrong. And this is consistent with Hayek's idea of economists making pattern predictions or explanations of principle. If you think about your demand and supply stuff that you do in Econ 101, you have the determinants of demand, you have the determinants of supply. You know in principle that these are the things that are going to affect the determination of the final price. It's just that you can't forecast where it's going to be. You make a pattern prediction, but not make the forecast. So I think it makes sense of things that everyday economists understand. He also thought it would be difficult adjudicating among theories that explain complex phenomena. And we see that today. I mean, economists, it's not like we have settled in on a particular worldview about which way, the kind of debates that Myrdal was having with Hayek are very similar to debates that are taking place today between those people who might advocate a more growth-oriented approach to those who might advocate a more redistributive approach to making a society a better place. And the arguments always seem to miss each other in terms of the debates. And I think it's because you're studying something as complex as the complex adaptive system that is the market system. His message is also that it's dangerous if the public comes to expect that economists can do more because the public's going to get disappointed, and then you're going to start getting kind of crank policy recommendations springing up. Here I'm going to invoke a saying of Henry Simons, who was a University of Chicago professor. This is something he had on his syllabus, his basically Econ 101 syllabus. Academic economics is primarily useful to both the student and to the political leader as a prophylactic against popular fallacies. That the major use of economics is to keep you from really undertaking policies that may sound good but end up being destructive and perhaps counterintuitive or counterproductive. Finally, I'll just mention the metaphor of the gardener This is something that he introduces, which is kind of a strange metaphor, but what he was trying to claim was that if you think of yourself as a gardener, you're trying to set up a situation in which plants can flourish, individual plants can flourish. You try to have an environment in which people can use their own knowledge, if they're not plants, but people, to be able to accomplish their goals. It's a very liberal message. He obviously was a defender of classical liberalism, so this is where he was coming from and using it. He does offer another final metaphor in his address in 1981 at the London School of Economics. This is my last comment. He gave an address in 1981, and he wanted to change metaphors again. And the metaphor that he wanted economists to start to embrace was a metaphor of a stream rather than of equilibrium. Now, Mary has written a wonderful book, The World and the Model. And in the final chapter of that book, she says the two things that really define economics are equilibrium and maximizing. So here he is challenging one of the two fundamental ideas that involve economics. That was Hayek. So thank you for your patience. I may have gone over a little bit. I hope not. But I'm done. Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So thank you, Bruce. That was a wonderful lecture, filling in all sorts of things I didn't know about Hayek, so I really put him together in a different way. So thank you very much. That was really great. And it raises the question for me, and I hope you've all got questions ready because I'm about to send people with microphones around there. But it does raise the question for me about the Nobel Prize Committee, who were purposely choosing people who disagreed. Or do you think there was a split committee and they were arguing against each other? I've often wondered really what happens in those kinds of spaces.
And should I repeat the question? Is that what people do?
Does the question get over?
You have a mic there too.
Yeah, so. No, I think, yeah, I've got a mic here and I've got a thumbs up there.
Okay.
But for those of you who are thinking up your questions, we've got mics here, and I'll be sending them out, and we'll start over there when you've thought about this one.
So how did the Nobel Prize Committee end up giving it jointly to two people who disagreed so much? And it's a great question. The deliberations of the Nobel Prize Committee are not public. They're very secretive. This is something that Myrdal complained about a couple of years later after Friedman got the Nobel Prize, and he thought, well, this is just outrageous. He was appalled and the rest. So he was wondering about how it happened, but there was no way to find out. Now, certainly Myrdal was somebody who I think within Sweden was known as, if the Swedish committee is going to give the prize to a Swede, it should be him.
Yeah.
Okay. So he knew that, and I think that the people who were on the committee probably also thought, yeah, he does want it pretty bad. Maybe we should give it to him, and maybe we'll just make it a little bit sweeter for us. So this is complete conjecture. I have no idea. These are secret. But in the various comments that I've heard about why this choice might have been made, that's the one that actually kind of makes the most sense to me.
Okay.
Might possibly been, you know, knowing colleagues, but maybe other people have other. You're shaking your head. Maybe you think a different reason. Maybe. Okay. All right.
Okay. So there's this person here with that. Yeah. Here. Yeah.
Good evening, Professor. Thank you for the talk. Really enjoyed it. Two quick questions. Firstly, you know, what are the honest questions in methodology that you think one can pursue? I am a MSc student and planning to do my PhD at some point. And this thing really troubles me, you know. Has mainstream economics, in your opinion, fallen to what Hayek calls scientism? Are all arguments, you know, validated only if you have some sort of an empirical claim about their validity, you know, the p-hacking stuff? Or, you know, and then when the data itself is subject to knowledge problems. So how do we try and combat that and have honest academic inquiry in this sort of an environment? And the second question is, how do we get romance with the market process, especially when it's so disorganized and stochastic in nature and not deterministic in nature, when the opposition to that is sort of a deterministic, deliberate intervention in planning, and some to the sort of questions that you raised about climate change, you know, which really riles people up to say that we can't leave it to uncertainty and we require rationalistic planning and these sort of things. Thank you.
These are your two short questions. Yeah. How would I change the economics profession and how do we study...
There's quite a lot of questions in the queue, so be aware.
Right. So I think in terms of the first question, first of all, economics was very different when I went through than it is now. I think it is much more open now, actually, in terms of the sorts of things that are allowed to be studied and that, that like Feyerabend once described scientists as opportunists. If you can figure out a method that allows you to gain a certain amount of insight into a particular thing, pursue it, because then you'll be doing something novel. But I mean, I think that question is something that you'd be better suited to just talking to some of your professors that you respect and figure out what kinds of answers they give. Now, what do you do if you're confronted with the study of something like the complex adaptive system, which is the economy? How do you make any progress, particularly if your progress is indicated in the way that the positivist or logical empiricist philosophy is? Well, I think you emphasize the things that you are actually, you feel like you have some insights into. So I mentioned basic economic reasoning. This is something that is something you get in Econ 101. But it's so powerful. I talked to Jeff Sachs. We had him to our university back in the 90s when he was running around the world giving advice to all these newly freed countries in Eastern Europe and et cetera. And I said, geez, you know, given all the stuff that you've learned, you know, all the high level economics, you know, what do you say to these people? He said, oh, it's Econ 101. It's Econ 101. That's what's useful in terms of being able to give, yeah, solid advice. Now, I'm not saying the other things are not useful, but I think the kind of basic economic reasoning that you get through an intermediate price theory course is something that's quite important to have under your belt. And Hayek's view was, being a good economist was necessary in terms of trying to understand social phenomena. But it wasn't sufficient, and economists who only know economics can end up being more dangerous than helpful. So trying to understand and communicate with other social sciences that are trying to grapple with the same problems. That's actually going too far, because I wouldn't want to presume to tell people the way to do things, but that's something I think Hayek would have argued for.
Okay, lady just next to you, thank you. And then this one here.
Yeah. Sit down. Hi, yeah, thank you very much for the lecture. It was super interesting. My question was a bit about Hayek's response to sort of like developments in philosophy of science, particularly in what's relevant to the LSE. So I was wondering if he was sort of like influenced by Popper's falsificationism, or maybe some of Lakatos's ideas on like programmatic science, or maybe even Kuhn's as well, and how these like Did this fit into his view of, you know, methodology in science?
Yeah. So Hayek met Popper in the 30s when Popper gave an early version of the poverty of historicism in Hayek's seminar. Popper goes to New Zealand. Are there any people from New Zealand here? Okay, in the back. I'm sorry, but Popper really didn't like New Zealand. he felt it. Intellectually isolated, there weren't good libraries, he felt alone. So they started a correspondence during World War II, and they realized that they were both interested in the same thing. Yeah. The poverty of historicism, and one of the things that Hayek had criticized in the scientism essay was historicism as an example of scientism. So they started this correspondence. They were coming from different backgrounds. Although they were both Viennese, that was a common one, but they didn't know each other in Vienna. So that Hayek was instrumental in bringing Popper to the London School of Economics, getting the Open Society and Its Enemies published. They maintain a correspondence throughout their lifetimes, and the person who's editing the correspondence volume between Hayek and Popper is sitting in the front row if you have any further questions. His name is Paul Lewis. He'll identify himself to you if you come up. Sorry, yeah.
And this one here, yeah. And then you're next, yep.
So my question is about Hayek's mark on today's mainstream economics. In which areas do you think in mainstream economics Hayek is still influential and relevant?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the notion that came out in the use of knowledge in society, this is something that is embraced by many, many economists, people who work in the economics of information back in the 70s and 80s going forward. But if you look at the person whose name is most invoked in other Nobel addresses, the first person was Kenneth Arrow, the second person was Hayek. So I think anyone who's interested in trying to figure out ways to make markets work better, acknowledge Hayek's ideas about why markets work at all. Because some people who would take an anti-market approach would say, yeah, you've got to convince me of that, so if you're going to start a conversation, that would be where it is. Now, it's not like he has a specific theorem or something like that that has been adopted by mainstream economists, but I think the general worldview of what the strength of market system might be is what Hayek's legacy would be. Also, his critique of socialism, at least among economists, it's always hard to generalize about a profession, but I would say that most economists will have bought the Misesian critique that, you know, if you don't have prices for, if you don't have nationalization of the means of production, you don't have prices for factors of production, it makes rational planning of the production difficult. And I think that's a basic insight that people like Oscar Lange, the reason he's a market socialist, is he said, yeah, they're right. So we've got to figure out a way to make socialism work in a way that's not this kind of central planning.
Thank you very much. Wonderful lecture. Thank you so much, Professor Caldwell. What I'm interested in is less academic, but it's more a case of where do you think Hayek had the most impact outside academia? Was it in the ideas of innovation, of entrepreneurialism? Was it in science, psychology, philosophy, or indeed in politics? Where do you think he was most impactful?
That's a great question. Now, I see Hayek as part of a stream. I don't know if Pete Betke is someone who talks about mainline versus mainstream economists, economics, and he defines mainstream as whatever's going on right now. And that will change, just as I said, you know, my training in the 70s versus the way economics in grad school is taught today is quite different. And that is going to be changing through time. But there's a mainline. Again, this is basic economic reasoning of insights that go back, you know, to Adam Smith and to Ricardo, to others. And he is part of that stream. So rather than looking at Hayek himself, I would say, take a look at that larger stream of ideas. And I think there are people who disagree severely with each and every aspect of that vision. But it is a coherent vision we live in a world of scarcity. It requires choices. Choices have opportunity costs and trade-offs. You have to make these, particularly if all resources are fully employed. If you want more of one thing, you have to have less of the other. You want to push against that by encouraging growth. So what sorts of things allow that growth to occur? Specialization, increasing human capital and physical capital, increasing population, and allowing these things to freely flow across borders. These are all ideas that they were promoting, that each and every one of them, as you know, following the politics of any country, have been challenged vociferously. But it is a consistent view of the world and how to make the world better. And I think that was something that they were working towards.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was good. I've passed through this institution in a variety of ways over quite a lot of years. I wondered, first of all, when you were talking, I wondered how Hayek fitted into this environment when he was there, since one learnt about the London School of Economics because one learnt about the webs and one learnt about a particular idea of science, which used to be written above the door in Latin, but has now been removed because nobody knows Latin perhaps, but that was very important. So he came to a place which had a very strong tradition. He also came to a place which historically, and I mean, I certainly remember when I came here as a graduate student, was regarded as a left-wing institution. One never quite understood why it was, and there was a lot of discussion about this. But he also came to an institution where in some of my time, and I'm not going to name names, there was a tendency for an aura of expertise amongst certain people who were here.
Yep.
And so I wondered, so how did he fit into this institution?
Yeah.
I think the thing which you taught me was this lesson about learning humility. I think that was very important. I think perhaps humility is something which comes with age, and maybe I've acquired a bit more of it as a result of that. But I think that was the very important thing that you taught us today, so I would like to thank you for that.
Thank you for your comments. So, the London School of Economics was founded by Fabian socialists, indeed, but they were quite confident in the doctrine. So they were looking to hire the best people that they could. They hired Lionel Robbins, and so there was a bevy of people who were more free market, who were sharing the same building with committed socialists. And indeed, in doing the research on this, I always love to point out that if you were lucky enough to be a student at LSE in the summer term in 1936, you could take a lecture from Hayek on why a collectivist economic approach wouldn't work. That's from 5 to 6, and from 6 to 7, you could take Evan Durbin's class on, socialist planning, how it works. You know, so I mean, you'd be able to get from the horse's mouth the two different views. He was someone who was part of a group, surely, who were more free market at the time in the 1930s, and they were, they were criticized, but it was a academic environment that welcomed the open discussion of views. And you know, if anything is the thing I'm most sad about about the universities these days, and I would say the bad rap that universities are getting, but in some cases it's actually true, of this absence of the ability to civilly disagree with one another and focus on the arguments. Hayek was someone who always focused on the arguments, even people who disagreed with him completely, theoretically, ideologically, and said he was someone who always, it was just his nature. He was born a liberal, I think, in that regard. If you think of liberal discourse in the broader sense of the word liberal, is something that he embraced. So I think he got along fine. He was somebody who actually was a very good networker. I think he was very smooth. I think, people would try to take care of him. He wasn't bumbling. He wasn't that, but he was somebody who would, we'll make sure things go well for him. He never. Of course, Robbins was somebody who took over a lot of academic administration, but Hayek was so happy to let someone else do that kind of stuff. So he was, this was something that you can see all this stuff in the correspondence. I've actually, working on the biography has been a wonderful a journey for me, because for the first three quarters of my academic life, it's all about ideas, and now I'm learning much more about the person, and it's actually quite interesting to try to put those two dimensions together.
Thank you. Should we go online and see what you have there?
All right. So there is a question from online. I think it's Professor Theo Papayan. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. To what extent Hayek's work on the sensory order was influenced by Ernest Marx's anti-metaphysical theory of sensations? And also, how relevant is Hayek's theory of complexity in the era of AI?
I was thinking the AI question would be the first one, because, of course, it's what's on everyone's mind. But the sensory order, it started out as an essay, a student essay, that Hayek wrote and never published, at the University of Vienna when he was there in 1920-21. And it was a direct response to Ernst Mach's views. So Mach was one of the people that he was criticizing, his vision of how brain's work was much more relational rather than point-to-point, repeatable over each time. And already I'm not doing a very good job of explaining Hayek's views because, as I said, I had to read it three times to get a sense of it. But it is a critique of the sort of Machian views that were just expressed there. Now, I don't know is the answer that I would give about the impact of AI on all these questions. Certainly the way that I would anticipate the question to have been asked is, now that we've got AI, with Hayek's critique about the knowledge problem as being a barrier to a socialist setup, not be refuted. And I think, we don't know, but my speculation would be that it's not going to make that difference. I talked to a person who was in AI, and he said it's really good at aggregating what we already know. Now, what about generative AI? I don't know. You know, what does generative AI really do? Is it really going to generate novelty of the sort that you get when you have interactions of humans trying to sell each other stuff? I don't know. But it certainly seems like what we've got now doesn't come close to duplicating what occurs in the market system, which is all sorts of emergent phenomena. But, when you say generative, that sounds like emergent, so I'm not sure. And I'm sure there's people in this room who would be far more sophisticated than me to ask this question about. I'm stuck in the 1950s right now, working with Hayek at the University of Chicago, working with Frank Knight and all sorts of strange people. Thank you.
Yeah, just behind Brian, this gentleman with the glasses. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. As a bond trader, I have a lot of sympathy for Hayek's humility in front of complex market systems with completely unpredictable outcomes. But your lecture left me wondering what Hayek saw as the main practical contribution or value of economics as a science. Mm-hmm. So obviously, a lot of arguments of what it shouldn't be or what it couldn't be, like, you know, improving, constructing social systems that work better, or making predictions. Was it about the plumbing of market infrastructure that he really thought that economics can add value to?
So I think when I said you need to be more than an economist, the book that I would recommend is The Constitution of Liberty. Because when Hayek came out with The Road to Serfdom, some people hated it. But some people who liked it and some people who hated it said, okay, good critique of socialism, but what's your preferred setup? What would you like in its place? This is something Keynes, who liked The Road to Serfdom very much, said to him. And I think you can read The Constitution of Liberty, the book that he wrote while he was at the University of Chicago, published in 1960, is an attempt to do that. Now, it's a liberal vision of a good society, okay? Walter Lippmann's, the Lippmann colloque was on Walter Lippmann's book, The Good Society. This is Hayek's attempt to describe it. And he describes a set of political institutions that would allow a protected sphere of individual activity. You give the power of coercion to the state, but you try to limit the state through various political setups. You know, just the standard things you'd learn in a intro poly theory or poli sci course. You have government, where you have executive separation of powers between executive, legislative, and judicial. You have judicial review. Might have a bicameral legislature. These are various sorts of institutions, but he also talked about the importance of the rule of law, the idea that all laws should be enforced equally. And this, if you take that and together with his ideas about the market system, where you think a lot of it is saying don't pursue policies that infringe on these sorts of things. And one way of getting the power of some of these things that he's talking about is that if you look at horrible state outcomes in Zimbabwe, for example, or in Venezuela, it is a systematic dismantling of these various things that he was arguing for that allows those sorts of situations to occur. It's almost like, let's do the opposite of everything that he's saying that we recommend, and you end up with those sorts of outcomes. I should also point out that He wants the price system to work, which means the prices need to be allowed to adjust. And many, many policies have to do with price fixing at their base. They're saying either we're trying to support this group, so we're going to not let the prices fall, or this group needs help, so we're not going to let these prices rise. And this interferes with the price system working in a way that produces good outcomes. It's still going to keep working, but it does send signals that are not as good. So, I mean, I think his lessons are both what not to do, but he does have a vision of a society that he thinks might be a good one as well.
In his Economics and Knowledge, Hayek argues that there is nothing within the pure logic of choice, pure economic theory, that can account for a tendency toward equilibrium or planned coordination. And so this must be an empirical element, as you have noted. In an article, Professor Kirzner has criticized this position by stating that it only applies to the Robinson conception of allocative choice and not to the Misesian actor. What are your thoughts on this criticism?
So the question was about economics and knowledge, and this is the article that Hayek published in 1937 in Economica, which was basically asking the question of how is it that what our subjective views are ever come to to match up with objective reality, okay? That we all have visions of what may be happening tomorrow and in the future and make our decisions. How do we get any kind of coordination? And he said, well, it really depends on the knowledge that you're looking at, okay? What knowledge is important? And he answers that question in the use of knowledge in society. Interestingly, even in that piece, that 1945 piece, he says, what's the most important type of knowledge? It's not scientific knowledge. It's the individual bits of knowledge that people have. Now, the other thing that you were talking about was the debate between Kirzner, Mises, Misesians, Hayekians, on methodological points. You know, was Hayek a Misesian? Was he not a Misesian? This has a long, long history. And I just don't think this is the right place to go into that long history. I will simply say that I think that Hayek disagreed with von Mises, but also was somebody who was so good that Mises forgave him in a way that Mises never forgives anybody who disagrees with him. So, I mean, I think it's a great question, but maybe it's one for a smaller group.
So I'd like to thank Bruce very much for a wonderful talk and great questions.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.